I'm standing in the center of Kyiv in a street of older buildings, many of which were divided up into communal apartments back in the 1920s. Now, most of them have been converted back into individual flats. In 2002, however, our interviewer Zhanna Litinskaya visited Dora Pastrelko, who was then 84 years old and was living in a single room in a shared communal apartment. Dora was very keen to tell her wartime story, and Zhanna visited with her three times that week. Sarah Kesselman reads Dora Pastrelko's story for us.
I have spent most of my life here in Kyiv. In fact, I have spent a half century in this one room in a collective flat. But I come from the shtetl of Tomaszpil. Our father was Aaron Getman. Our mother, Sora Weinstein. My sister Hannah was born in May 1915. I was born in November 1918. Our father didn't just leave Judaism behind, which was rare in shtetls like ours. He left our family and took up with another woman. He moved with her to Leningrad. Our mother died of a broken heart. Hannah and I spent much of our childhood in horrible orphanages, and we finished school in Kyiv. Hannah did very well in her studies, but she came down with tuberculosis in 1936. But she made a strong recovery and began to date her fellow student, Sasha Goldberg. They planned to get married after finishing college, but life has its own rules. On the 22nd of June, 1941, the Great Patriotic War began, but we didn't know anything about this war in Europe, and it came as a complete surprise to us. This was just when Hannah graduated, and she'd been given a mandatory job assignment in Krukov on the Dnieper, a small town near Kremenchug, around 250 kilometers from Kyiv. She was going to work in the rail car repair plant there, and I quit my job because I wanted to be with her. Sasha was sent off to fight, but just before he left, he took us to his mother, and she helped us get on a ship sailing down the Dnieper to Kremenchug. The ship was overcrowded and German planes attacked us, dropping bombs, but none of them, thank God, hit us. People were screaming. We arrived in Kremenchug at night while bombs were exploding all around. We were afraid our eardrums would burst. We hid in some craters until the bombing stopped. Then we crossed the Dnieper on a barge to get to Krukov. It was a settlement made up of a plant, a dormitory, and a village. We were given a room, and Hannah went to work in this giant factory where they were repairing rail cars damaged in the fighting. But on the 6th of August, 1941, German troops landed a few kilometers away. Hannah rushed to the plant to find somebody to take us to the railway station, but everyone had fled. An old caretaker told her there was a ship on the Dnieper that was taking people to the railway station, which was on the other side of the river. We started running, but Hannah got so winded and had to rest. I feared that her tuberculosis was coming back. Oh no, I thought, not that, not here, not now. We reached the Dnieper. It was incredibly wide, and we saw a ship filled with women and children approaching. Suddenly, it was hit by a bomb and sank in minutes. People on the bank were crying and running, looking to help them, but also to get across the river. The Germans were closing in behind us. I found a small leaky rowboat under some brambles. A big man approached from nowhere and he loaded all our belongings onto it and pushed it into the water. Some people started wading into the water, begging us to take them with us, grabbing the boat, but this skiff was barely big enough for even three people. It started leaking and we cried and apologized and broke free. As we crossed this mighty river, it started to rain and Hannah was hacking and coughing non-stop. We made it to the far bank. And this man who had saved us, ran away. There we were, alone and completely lost. I yelled out, "Help! Help!" And right in front of me, the weeds parted and our soldiers were there, telling me to shut up, and pointed us down the road. We found a train full of people. When they saw how bad Hannah looked, they shifted to make some space for us. She looked like she could die any moment. A few moments later, the train was off. When it stopped, our fellow travelers brought tea and boiling water for Hannah and gave us some food. We arrived in Donetsk, I think it is 500 kilometers from Kyiv, and we slept in a kolkhoz, a collective farm, and stayed there for a week, letting Hannah recover. There were Jews from Western Ukraine on that train, and they told us about what the Germans were doing to Jews. It was devastating to hear. At last, we got onto a train, a real passenger train, headed for Kuibyshev. It's now Samara, a city on the Volga River, about 1,500 kilometers from Kyiv. Hannah was ideally qualified to work as an engineer on the construction of the gas pipeline, and she did well. But when winter set in, Hannah collapsed. And by February 1942, I brought her to a hospital. An elderly Jewish doctor, a woman, took me aside and told me I would lose Hannah in a few weeks and that I should just take her home and make her comfortable. There was nothing, she told me, she could do for my sister. I brought Hannah back to our room, and she kept getting worse. Then she begged me to take her back to the hospital. She didn't want me to watch her die. That elderly doctor sent an ambulance and stretcher. Hannah died at night on the 14th of April, 1942. Some workers stayed awake that night and made a coffin. A few men and I tried to take the coffin to the cemetery, but the roads, after the winter snows, had become impassable. We came upon a few other graves, Jews mostly, who had also fled in evacuation and died in this godforsaken place. We buried my beloved sister there at the edge of the forest. I stayed on in Kuibyshev and worked on the pipeline. In the meantime, Hannah's fiancé, Sasha Goldberg, kept writing to her, and I didn't have the heart to tell him the truth, so I wrote him back and pretended I was Hannah. Later, as the war was ending, I wrote Sasha and told him the truth. He wrote me back a long letter asking me to send him her photographs. I did. And that was my only contact with Sasha Goldberg until one day, it was in 1960 in Kyiv, that I ran into him on the street. We stood there talking for a while. He told me he'd been at the front and had been wounded. After the war, he got married. I never saw him again after that. As for me, I never really married. I mean, I did for a very short time, a few weeks, but I don't want to talk about that. I will tell you that I made it back to Kyiv in June 1944. Most of our family had been murdered, but I found out my father was still alive. My father! He wanted to come to see me, but I felt horribly conflicted. After all, he had abandoned us, and we went through hell because of him. But still, I was longing for a father's warmth, or maybe I just wanted to know that there was someone of my own flesh and blood still alive. I wrote him a letter and began it with the words, "Hello, my unknown father." He came to Kyiv immediately, brought me gifts and money and clothes. He had his own tale of woe. Father and his second wife, the woman he had left my mother for, had moved to Leningrad in the 1920s. They had had two sons. When the war began, father served in the army and was wounded. One of his sons came to see him in hospital, then went off to the front, where he was killed. My father's wife starved to death during the siege of Leningrad. Their second son made it out, but did not want further contact with my father. So we had both lived through hell, and I forgave him. I realized that I loved him so much and was happy when in 1947 he married a very nice Jewish woman, Lisa. He and I kept up a steady correspondence. He continued to send me gifts, but we rarely saw each other. He died in Leningrad in 1968, 73 years old. And I have stayed in this flat all these years.